Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for words and their stories and people in America, coming up after As It Is.
Hello, and welcome to As It Is. I'm Mario Ritter in Washington.
And I'm Anna Mateo. On our program today, we hear what the United Nations has to say about children living in areas of conflict.
Never in recent history have we seen so many children directly impacted by conflict, by war, by violence.
First, we turn to changes in the United States Congress. The Republican Party takes control of both houses of Congress this month. Today, we hear how this could affect U.S. foreign policy during the last 2 years of Barack Obama's presidency. A new U.N. report on conflicts affecting children, and Republicans speak out about foreign policy. Next, on As It Is.
Some of President Barack Obama's loudest critics will have more power in 2015. They will take leadership positions in the United States Senate when the Republican Party takes control of Congress in January. Republicans already control the House of Representatives. Senate Republicans are often critical of U.S. foreign policy under President Obama. As we hear from Bob Doty, the president's policies will be examined even more closely.
Republican lawmakers are often quick to criticize President Obama on issues from Ukraine to the Middle East. Senator Bob Corker is a Republican from Tennessee.
I have no earthly idea how the administration plans to go about degrading and destroying ISIS in Syria. I have no earthly idea.
Senator John McCain has also been critical of the Obama administration.
This president does not understand Vladimir Putin. He does not understand his ambitions. He does not understand that Vladimir Putin is an old KGB colonel bent on restoration of the Russian Empire.
In January, Mr. Corker will become chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Mr. McCain will lead the Senate Armed Services Committee. Stuart Rothenberg studies U.S. politics.
John McCain rarely pulls punches, and he's quite sure of what needs to be done and that the president isn't doing it.
Mr. Rothenberg says Congress can have an effect on a president's dealings with other countries. William Howell is a political scientist at the University of Chicago. He says Republican-led congressional committees are sure to question President Obama's decisions during his last 2 years in office.
Politically, they have powerful incentives to underscore what they perceive to be the failings of the Obama administration in foreign policy. What they can do is they can set the terms of the discussion that are going to ensue. They can say, we're going to have investigations.
President Obama has also been criticized by lawmakers from his own party. Democratic Senator Robert Menendez does not agree with the administration's policy toward nuclear negotiations with Iran.
Right now we are playing right into the Iranian narratives.
Thomas Pickering is a former U.S. ambassador.
Polarization is deep in the American Congress now.
Ambassador Pickering knows the senators who will chair committees next year. He believes they will do what is right for the country.
My own sense is that both Senator McCain and Senator Corker have shown strong periods of serious responsibility for the national interest.
The foreign policy fights could begin as soon as Congress meets in January. Senator Corker says lawmakers want to take stronger economic and diplomatic actions against Iran if nuclear negotiations fail. I'm Bob Doty.
UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund, says 2014 has been the worst year ever for children in areas affected by conflict. Christopher Cruz has more.
UNICEF says 2014 was a year of fear and despair for millions of children. Sarah Crowe is UNICEF's crisis communications chief. She says children have been forced to become soldiers, sold as sex slaves, and have been targeted by armed groups.
It's been an appalling, devastating year for children, and children have been put in harm's way like never before. Never in recent history have we seen so many children directly impacted by conflict, by war, by violence. 15 million directly and 230 million indirectly, meaning in chronic low conflict zones, war zones. The numbers are truly numbing.
UNICEF says children have been killed while studying in their classroom and while sleeping in their beds. They have been kidnapped and tortured, and their parents have been killed. The agency says the beginning of civil wars in the Central African Republic and in South Sudan 1 year ago has placed millions of children in danger. It says fighting in these countries has forced hundreds of thousands of children to flee their homes. UNICEF says many children have been killed or severely injured, and tens of thousands are suffering from severe malnutrition and disease. UNICEF also reports wars in the Middle East are causing the deaths of many women and children. It says 538 children were killed in last summer's 50-day-long conflict in Gaza, and 54,000 are homeless. It reports women and girls in Iraq are sexually attacked, sold as slaves, and forced into prostitution. It says many of the more than 7.3 million children affected by conflict in Syria have been killed or badly injured. And it says children in both countries have increasingly become victims of extreme violence. UNICEF says more than 100,000 children have been displaced since the Russian-supported rebellion in Ukraine began in April. Although there are many problems, UNICEF says there is also hope for the millions of children affected by conflict. It notes that the United Nations and private agencies have been giving aid. Lives have been saved, and children have been educated, and they have been given emotional support to help them deal with what they experienced. I'm Christopher Cruz.
Thank you, Chris. I'm Mario Ritter.
And I'm Anna Mateo. Join us again tomorrow for another As It Is program on The Voice of America.
Words and Their Stories is next, followed by People in America. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
Thank you. now, the VOA Special English Program, Words and Their Stories. Today's word, pan, takes us back to the days of the gold rush in California. On January 24, 1848, a man named James Wilson Marshall discovered gold in the territory of California. The news spread quickly. Thousands rushed west. They traveled on foot, by horseback, and by boat to reach the gold fields. By 1849, the great gold rush was on. Towns and cities grew overnight. Throughout the territory, in the mountains, along the streams and rivers, thousands of people searched for gold. They had food to eat and blankets to cover them. They also had mules to ride and picks and pans to search for gold. Some found areas of mountain rock thick with gold. These men got rich. But such areas were few and quickly claimed by the first men to find them. Others searched for gold in the rivers coming down the mountains. They were after pieces of gold that the rains had washed down from above. The only way to find this gold was by panning. First, a gold miner put dirt in a metal pan and added water. Then he shook the pan so that the water would wash the dirt. Slowly, he poured the water out of the pan. If he was a lucky miner, pieces of gold would remain. Across the nation, newspapers carried stories of the gold being found. One told how thousands of people climbed the mountains looking for gold. Some stories told how others followed the rivers and streams with pans. Each one hoped that the place he claimed panned out well, had some gold. For many, gold mining did not pan out. For a few, it panned out well. But in time, huge machines were built that could wash many tons of dirt at a time. Panning died out. The word, however, remained in the language. Today, Americans still say, "It panned out well," when something they have done pleases them. A business, a discovery, a simple event pans out well if it is successful. Unhappily, sometimes things do not pan out. In recent years, the word pan has taken on another meaning. Today, it also means to criticize. How it got this meaning is hard to discover, but the job of a critic is to sometimes pan the work of a writer, artist, or singer. Sometimes, critics may pan a movie or play so severely that no one will go to see it. There are times, however, when a play became highly successful even though most of the critics panned it without mercy. The pans should have washed out the play. But as actors have pointed out, sometimes a critic's pan turns up gold. This VOA Special English Program, Words and Their Stories, was written by Herb Sutcliffe. I'm Warren Shear.
I'm Shirley Griffith.
And I'm Steve Ember with the special English program, People in America. Every week, we tell about someone important in the history of the United States. Today, we complete the story of writer F. Scott Fitzgerald.
In 1925, just 5 years after his first novel appeared, F. Scott Fitzgerald published The Great Gatsby. It was a major event in American writing. The Great Gatsby is a story about success, American success, and what one must do to gain it. It is a story about appearance and reality. It is a story about love, hate, loyalty, and disloyalty. This is how the story begins.
In my younger years, my father gave me some advice. The ability to do what is good and right is not given out equally at birth. The rich and powerful, who should have it, often do not. And those who were born knowing neither good nor right sometimes know it best.
Jay Gatsby, the main character in the book, learns this moral lesson. He dies at the end of the story. Yet his spirit survives because of his great gift for hope. It was the kind of hope, Fitzgerald said, that he had never found in any person. Yet it was hope that used Gatsby and finally, in the end, destroyed him. Gatsby is a self-made man. Almost everything about his life is invented, even his name. He was born Jimmy Gatz. As a child, Jimmy Gatz sets a daily program of self-improvement. These are the things he feels he must do every day to make himself a success.
When Jimmy Gatz invents himself as Jay Gatsby, part of his dream of success is the love of a beautiful woman. He finds the woman to love, as Fitzgerald did, while training in the army during World War I. The other part of his dream is to be very rich. That, too, was part of Fitzgerald's dream. In just 3 years, Gatsby gains more money than he thought possible. All he needs to do now is to claim the woman he loves. In those same 3 years, however, she has married someone else. The story of The Great Gatsby is told by a narrator, Nick Carraway. When Gatsby seeks to renew his earlier love, Carraway says, "I would not ask too much. You cannot repeat the past." Gatsby answers, "Cannot repeat the past? Why, of course you can."
For a brief time, Gatsby seems to succeed. He does not know that he can never succeed completely. The woman he loves, Daisy Buchanan, is part of the very rich world that Fitzgerald found so different. It is a group that does not share what it has with people like Jay Gatsby. Fitzgerald wrote,
"They were careless people. They smashed up things and creatures. Then they retreated back into their money or their great carelessness or whatever it was that kept them together. They retreated and let other people clean up the messes they had made."
The mess they make in The Great Gatsby is a tragic one. They hit a woman with a car and kill her. Gatsby accepts the blame so Daisy will not be charged. He then is killed by the dead woman's husband. Not even Gatsby's few friends come to his funeral. Of all of the hundreds of people who came to his parties, no one will come when the party is over. After Gatsby's death, Nick Carraway, the storyteller, says,
I thought of Gatsby's wonder when he first recognized the green light at the end of Daisy's boat dock. He had come a long way to this blue lawn. His dream must have seemed so close that he could hardly fail to hold it. He did not know that it was already behind him. Gatsby believed in the future that year by year moves away from us. So we beat on, boats against the current, carried back endlessly into the past.
The Great Gatsby was not the popular success F. Scott Fitzgerald expected. Yet, other writers saw immediately how skillful he had become. His first books showed that he could write. The Great Gatsby proved that he had become an expert in the art of writing. The story is told by a third person. He is a part of the story, but he rejects the story he is telling. His answers are like those heard in an ancient Greek play. The chorus in the play tells us what to think about what we see. The Great Gatsby is a short novel whose writing shines like a jewel. The picture it paints of life in America at that time, the parties, the automobiles, the endless fields of waste, are unforgettable.
Fitzgerald wrote at great speed to make money. Yet, no matter how fast he wrote, he could not stay out of debt. By the end of the 1920s, the jazz age had ended. Hard times were coming for the country and for the Fitzgeralds.
In 1930, Zelda Fitzgerald became mentally sick. She lived most of the rest of her life in mental hospitals. Scott Fitzgerald also became sick from drinking too much alcohol, and he had developed the disease diabetes. In 1931, the Fitzgeralds returned to the United States from Europe. Zelda entered a mental hospital in the state of Maryland. Scott lived nearby in the city of Baltimore. Zelda lived until 1948. She died in a fire at another mental hospital.
In 1934, Fitzgerald wrote another novel, Tender is the Night. He thought it was his best. Many critics disagreed. They said Fitzgerald no longer recognized what was happening in the United States. They said he did not understand what was important to the country during the Great Economic Depression. Tender is the Night tells the story of a young American doctor and his marriage to a rich, beautiful patient. In the early part of his life, he believes in success through hard work. Slowly, however, his wife's great wealth ruins him. His energy is weakened, his work destroyed. His wife recovers her health, while he becomes worse. In the end, she seems to have stolen his energy and intelligence.
In 1936, Fitzgerald wrote a book he called The Crack-Up. It describes his own breakdown and how he attempted to put himself and his life together. It seemed a romantic business to be a successful writer, he said. Of course, you were never satisfied. But I, for one, would not have chosen any other work. At the age of 39, he realized that his life had cracked into pieces. It became a time for him to look at himself. He realized that he had not taken care of the people and things he loved. "I had not been a very good caretaker of most of the things left in my hands," he said, "even of my own skills." Out of the wreckage of his life and health, he tried to rebuild himself.
Fitzgerald had always written many stories. Some were very good. Others were not good. He wrote quickly for the money he always needed. After his crack-up, however, he discovered he was no longer welcome at the magazines that had paid him well. So, to earn a living, he moved to Hollywood and began writing for the motion picture industry. He had stopped drinking. He planned to start writing novels and short stories again. It was too late. His health was ruined. He died in Hollywood in 1940 at the age of 44. There were few people who could believe that he had not died years before.
Fitzgerald was working on a novel when he died. He called it The Last Tycoon. Fitzgerald's friend from Princeton University, the literary critic Edmund Wilson, helped to get it published. Wilson did the same thing for a book of Fitzgerald's notes and other pieces of writing called The Crack-Up. These books reestablished Fitzgerald's fame as both an observer of his times and a skilled artist. That fame rests on just a few books and stories, but it seems secure.
Today's program was written by Richard Thorman and produced by Lawan Davis. I'm Steve Ember.
And I'm Shirley Griffith. Join us again next week for another People in America program in Special English on the Voice of America.